human vision.
Distance?
No wavelength.
Between 4,000 angstrom units and 7,800 angstrom units. You know that.
Less than one-tenth of the actual wave spectrum. What could we really see if we had access to the other 90%? Sam, we are virtually blind. All of us. You tell me that my eyes are perfect. Well, they're not. I'm blind to all but a tenth of the universe.
My dear friend, only the gods see everything.
My dear doctor, I'm closing in on the gods.
Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 270. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from the central coast of Eastern Australia, the heart of whale dreaming country, the location where Homo sapiens has had the longest standing and most intensive and conscious relationship with whales and dolphins of any place on this whole planet, as far as I understand it myself. But that's not the topic of today's show. This show is a show that I've been thinking of recording for a long time. It's called Gotcha by the Balls: Seeing, Believing, and Critical Thinking in the Age of Infotoxin. Now, this relates to one of two of my primary research projects that's been going on really since I quit college in the late 1970s. Parallel and synergistically interrelated is my work with and on behalf of the whales and dolphins, understanding who they are as fellow beings and what the real global threats to their well-being are, and the understanding of how humans communicate or convince ourselves that we do, and the psychology and weaponization of mass communication, which began as a concept that came to me when I was sitting in a cafe in Berkeley, California in 1984, I think it was, the word infotoxin. And to me, it was funny. It was a product. Like, you'd go out and buy some infotoxin or consume some, watch some on TV. I recorded it as a techno rap song in Atlanta in 1985 and got airplay on maybe a dozen or so college radio stations all over the country, which was pretty cool. And but then I started thinking about it and developing it as a serious concept, and had two articles published in Canadian magazines, one of which was Adbusters, which back then used to be really cool. And I think it was published in the 1995 or 1996 episode. They credited me with coining the term infotoxin and coming up with a new discipline, information toxicology. It's Saturday, the 23rd of March, by the way. This show is being recorded kind of as a response to the sequence of events that have unfolded in New Zealand since Friday a week ago, just a few days after I was out of there to come back to Australia. I'm very thankful to my guardian angels for getting me out of New Zealand before all this fecal matter hit the fan. But I'd been thinking about recording a show like this in honor of the whole climate change thing, because I've been watching that for, well, since really, since its whole inception, probably around 1990, and it's foisting as a meme or ideology that's being spread using every possible technique of engineering the public mind ad nauseum. And it's just so pervasive and so easy to see exactly what's going on. I even thought of calling it the Manhattan Project of PR, public relations. But now with this shooting incident in New Zealand, you can just see exactly what it is. It's not what we're led to believe. But the title of the show, I'll give a little background on all this. In 1992, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, and I went and saw this guy named Timothy Leary. You know, remember the guy from Harvard who became the LSD guru back in the 1960s? And so he was on speaking tour in Atlanta, and I went and saw him, and he had a few interesting things to say, but he seemed like somebody that had severe neurological damage. He'd be talking about a really cool idea for a few minutes, and then all of a sudden he would just stop talking and stand there for like 30 seconds or more, just in silence, while he seemed to be trying to figure out what he was going to say. And then he would start in on an entirely new topic. So he didn't really have any coherent thread to what he was talking about, but several of the things he did talk about were quite interesting. And the thing that stuck with me was this. He said that there's a traditional expression that we have, maybe in America, if to have someone by the balls, they've got you by the balls. It means by your testicles, your nuts that the men have, and some women, especially in Australia. But if you got somebody by the balls, they're in control of you for that time, because there is such a sensitive area that could exert such excruciating pain if someone has you by the balls, that you're going to do anything they say. You're going to believe, say, do, pretend, admit, confess, anything while they've got you by the balls. Okay, well, Timothy Leary said in the world of today, i.e. the world saturated of n-dimensional mass media communications technologies, that the expression to have someone by the balls means by the eyeballs. And when you think about it, it's extraordinarily powerful, because we are highly visual beings, Homo sapiens. Our primary sensory input is our eyes. I think if you look at the number of nerve fibers that go from the eyes and the retina into the brain, it's huge, way more than any of our other senses, hearing, taste, smell, tactile. Whereas, I'm not an expert on any of this, of course, but I believe that if you look at the neurobiology of whales and dolphins, cetaceans in general, they have an equivalent larger amount of neurological connections between their hearing and sound apparatus into their brain than their eyes, in the same proportion that we have with visual. So that's another story in itself. But to have somebody by the balls means that they're controlling what you see. And so this is a huge area of investigation and awareness, because when you step back and think about how each of us is very profoundly influenced by mass communication, and it really began with the dawn of radio after the turn of the 20th century, and then with the advent of television, really in the 1950s, a Canadian researcher named Joyce Nelson wrote a book called The Perfect Machine, Television in the Nuclear Age. And it's a brilliant analysis of the origins of television, primarily by a company called General Electric, who interestingly had board members that were simultaneously Wall Street bankers and bankers in Nazi Germany. They built, designed, and implemented the first nuclear reactors and the first wave of televisions that were publicly marketed. And one of the things that Nelson points out is that one of the original uses of television was to sell A, the Cold War, and B, the peaceful atom. So these are ideologies or memes that mass media, from its very inception, was designed to be a marketing technology for. So that the origin of television is not as entertainment. It's a weapon system from day one. And so if you think about how much time people spend in front of television screens, it's an unbelievable percentage of time. If you look at the total number of people there are, and how many television sets there are, and how much time people spend sitting in front of it, it would be probably almost as great. And scary to think, what if it's greater? What if we had this actual statistic, what if it was actually greater than the amount of time that people spend sleeping? Now that would be a very interesting statistic to have. So maybe I'll just have to make one up, and I'll put on a white lab coat or a suit and tie, and you'll believe me. So that was a really cool concept that Timothy Leary shared, Got You by the Balls, and so I sort of integrated that in Darwin in 2004. I was there doing a bunch of artwork and living on my friend's sailboat, Peter Chumley, and I'd go up to the office of his art gallery every night and use the computer, because at this time I did not own a computer yet. And I started organizing all this information, and I came up with the concept of regain your brain, because that's really what we need to do, to regain our brains that have been stolen from us or that we've given away. And so I started working on this new website and actually got it up and running there in Darwin in 2004, regainyourbrain.org. And I put a lot of comprehensive archival information on there that's on there now, and I'm so glad that I did, because the articles themselves are on the website. They're not just links, so it can't just disappear or go down, and a lot of this stuff would be impossible to find anymore. But Got You by the Balls, I drew a little bumper sticker that shows a schematic diagram of a television with an arrow shooting out of the front of it, and some guns, rifles, and hypodermic syringes all going into the face of this little person that's sitting there. But the arrow and the guns have fish hooks on them that are snagged through the eyeballs of this person, and they're jerking the eyeballs out of his head. And he's got a t-shirt on that says Big Brother, and he's holding his hands up, and all of his money is flying out of his hands up into the air. So this is called Got You by the Balls. But it's really an appropriate motto for the world of today. So marketing, the history of marketing goes back to, ever since the invention of capitalism and money and selling, people have marketed stuff. You know, when marketing originally meant where you'd go to the market and lay all your stuff out there for sale, where people could actually see it. But then in the world of today, in the 20th century, marketing became the use of mass communication to sell not only products, but entire ideologies or mentalities. And this show can't possibly be a full-scale, comprehensive elucidation of the whole mass communication thing. I drew a diagram back around 1990 that I don't have a copy of anymore, but I was working on making a new one. It's a very detailed graphic called the Genome of Infotoxin, and it's laid out in a circular radial format in the way that they write, that they draw the genome of an organism. It contains all the different aspects and dimensions of the whole information toxicology paradigm. But a very essential person in the history of the weaponization of mass communication was a guy named Edward Bernays. That's Bernays. He was a step-half-nephew of Sigmund Freud. So he came from a psychologically sophisticated family. He lived in New York, and he wrote a book called The Manufacture of Consent. And he's got another book called Propaganda. And so I haven't read these cover to cover, but I've read parts of them, and I know that they're basically blueprints for really what we see going on in the world of today, in the sense of how people who wish to control and manipulate others, how they would go about it. One of the things he specialized in was, he said, don't wait for news to happen. Make it. Create news. And so, by implication, he's talking about creating fake news, staging events, creating gatherings, protests, marches, all this stuff. And it's the public is led to believe that it somehow spontaneously happens. But no, ever since back then, all this stuff, every protest you see pretty much has been organized. It didn't just spontaneously happen. People organize it for different reasons, but it's really not what you think most of the time, especially international groups of people protesting and stuff like that. Anyway, Edward Bernays was involved in the marketing of cigarettes and the imagery of it being associated with women's liberation. He also came up with the idea of the panel of experts. You've heard it a million times. 9 out of 10 doctors agree that Crest toothpaste has been shown to be of significant value when used in a conscientiously applied program of oral hygiene and regular professional care. I don't know why my brain actually remembers that from a box of Crest toothpaste. Maybe it's all the fluoride I ingested as a kid, but the panel of experts, if it shows the guys with the lab coats on, and a lot of this, it's just the instantaneous visual perception of who people perceive as authority figures, that they're going to listen to what they say. So the panel of experts, he would just pull random people off the street and say, like, hey, look, put on this lab coat, you're going to be Dr. Smith, and you over there, put on that jacket, you're going to be Dr. Johnson, and you're going to tell why your research supports this hypothesis and why this product is actually the best, you know, for all these different medical reasons. It's complete, utter bullshit, but this has been used a million times, the panel of experts, and people totally exploit this, possibly even without acknowledging it themselves. And then a Stanford researcher named Stanley Milgram, M-I-L-G-R-A-M, did a legendary experiment back in the, I guess it was in the 1970s, where he set up an environment, a laboratory, where it looked like that there was people down in the laboratory room, and they were sitting in a chair with electrodes hooked up to them, and then there was a researcher putting on the electrodes, and the researcher was going to press a button and administer electric shocks to these people. And then up in the control room was Milgram, along with the people who he was actually studying. They were the people invited into the control room to participate in the decision-making process about the level of electric shock that was going to be delivered to these people. Now, unbeknownst to the actual subjects of the experiment, who were the guests from the street in the control room, they thought that the people down in the laboratory were actually receiving a real electric shock. But they weren't. They were actors designed to simulate the effects of what might happen if they were delivered electric shocks at different levels. And so, I'm not sure exactly what Milgram said, but it had to do with they were studying the effects of the electric shocks on people, probably for something very highfalutin and important, like national security, to protect us against evil enemy, or possibly how we might extract information from a foreign, you know, terrorist that's been captured or something like that, a spy, how we'd get it out of them. And so what he would do is he'd say, like, okay, now we're going to deliver 50 volts to this person, you know, and you reckon that's okay? And they'd say, yeah. So then they'd press the button, and the person might, you know, the guy in the chair might jolt a little bit. And then he'd say, like, well, look, now we're going to turn the voltage up a little bit here. Now we're getting into maybe a danger zone where the person's really going to experience some discomfort. And he said, well, are you okay with that? And they'd go, like, well, yeah, go ahead. If it's in the interest of national security, I think it's important that we do this. And so they would do that, and the guy would kind of shake around a little bit and go, oh, my God. And then Milgram would say, well, now look, you know, and the guy hasn't been talking so far, so now we're going to jack up the voltage into the zone that could possibly be lethal for some people. It might cause a heart attack or arrest or something like that, and he'd look the people in the eye and ask if it was okay, and they'd say, like, well, you know, I think some of them wouldn't agree to it, but then others would, and they'd go, like, well, if this is what it takes to get this important information out of them, then yes, I think that we should do it. So then they would pretend like they shocked the person with like 200 volts, and they'd sit there and shake around, and there's a video of this experiment that you can see. I don't think that they pretended to kill anybody, but what shocked Milgram and the revelation from the whole thing was how many people from the street were fully okay with going to the lethal level of the electric shock that they thought was being administered. So, in other words, he was studying the perception of authority in the public and how gullible or malleable were people were to being, to obeying whatever a perceived authority figure told them. So this kind of thing is in operation all the time. When you think of all the authority figures that you perceive in your life, and not only in your day-to-day life, which would be, of course, your parents, your teachers, your priests, your police, your doctors, your lawyers, your dentist, people who's have authority, either implicit or explicit, that you aren't going to even think about disobeying or questioning their word. You know, if you talk back to your parents, you might get a slap upside the head or punished. If you talk back to a police, you might get a ticket or arrested. You talk back to your dentist, he might drill out 5 teeth that didn't even have a cavity. If you talk back to your doctor who told you you had cancer, he might just go like, look, we're not going to give you that chemotherapy. You're just going to have to go and eat a bunch of raw fruits and vegetables and heal yourself. But the biggest forms of authority are on television. The news. How many people turn on the news expecting it to be fake? No, because if you had that attitude, why bother to turn it on? Why ingest poison into your mind? Yet, this is what we're doing all the time. You know, and you have to look at the whole thing of mass media, where it comes from, who the television and radio networks are. It's very important to realize that they're corporations whose agenda, whose underlying purpose for existing is not to provide the service that they're providing, mass media content, entertainment, information. No, the primary reason that them or any corporation exists is to generate profits for their shareholders. They're actually required by law in the founding documents of the corporation. They have to do that at all costs. And many people don't realize that not now and not ever, not in America, and I don't think in any other country, there's no law that requires any form of mass media to tell the truth, regardless of whether they believe it's true or can verify that it's true. There's no law or regulation. There's not even a level of toxicity factor that comes in. You know, like supposedly the Environmental Protection Agency has set levels that, you know, you can only have this amount of parts per million of lead in your drinking water. You can only have this many parts per million of mercury in your vaccine. You can only have this much amount of strontium-90, blah, 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 blah. All the stuff, they set these minimum limits, which are in themselves bullshit, because for all the stuff, there's no such thing as a safe level. But at least they've given an impression that you can't legally have more than that. But did they ever set anything like that for the quality of mass media? No. There's no limit to... I don't think it's illegal for a news outlet to provide information that's completely fake and they know it. I don't think that that's illegal. But people don't understand that. And even if it was illegal, that's not going to slow them down or stop them. Because it's all based on marketing the ideology that you're being paid to market. And implicit in everything we see is we're supposed to trust the government. We're supposed to trust the news outlet. We're supposed to trust all these journalists and reporters and stuff like that. And we're supposed to just open our mouth and let the little spoon go in there, just like a little baby eating its Gerber pre-digested pap. It doesn't ask any questions about what it's getting or where its mom got that food from. It just opens its mouth like a little bird to have its meal regurgitated right down its throat. So every time we turn on mass media, the majority of people are approaching it in that kind of way. They're uncritically assimilating pap. They're not even thinking about where this came from, what it is. Out of the whole spectrum of things that have happened that day, which is literally billions of different things all over the world, in every possible sphere of existence and reality, there could be a billion different things on the news, but why is it always the same small subset of stuff every day? Why is every day, there's some international terrorism, often involving Muslims, there's, you know, that there's dominant themes. And then in the past decade or two, the whole Muslim terrorist thing has been replaced by the bogey of climate change. So these are memes. They're ideologies that have been marketed by the powers that be. And we think of news outlets, we think of television stations and broadcast channels and networks and all this stuff. But beyond that, there are organizations and factions within organizations who have sought, at least since World War II, to control mass media as a whole, and to therefore be in control of the orchestration and engineering of what the public perceives as reality. And one of these organizations is the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. They had a project back in the 1950s called Project Mockingbird, where they said that their goal was to take over, to in other words, by taking over, that means that they put one of their people in the highest levels of control of an organization. They would have a former CIA person or operative or agent as the editor of the New York Times, for example, or as the CEO of NBC. So I think that they've been working on this since the 1950s, and it's just like with MK Ultra, the legendary mind control experimental stuff. It didn't stop in the 1970s, like they're saying. Operation Mockingbird didn't suddenly stop because they go like, oh no, you know, this is not something we should do. All it does is it changes form, it changes name, and it diversifies and spins out daughter products just like radioactive decay. And it keeps on doing the same thing at ever deeper levels of penetration and saturation and embedment into the whole institutions. So that now, in the world of today, I would say that every major mass media is under direct or indirect control by various factions of the global intelligence communities. And I think that they pretty much all work together. It's sort of like what we call HARP, the ionospheric heaters. It's not just one technology. It's a network that's in many countries, but they're all linked together. All the navies of the world, probably even Russia and China, use technology made by the same companies, like Raytheon, the underwater microwave weapon systems. The enemies use the same technology. The same with all the different channels of mass media. It's all come from the same sources. And all the different intelligence factions, whether you've got the KGB, MI5, Mossad, CIA, all this different kind of stuff. It's all really one network of people. It's man the wise against reality. One of the tricks that's been in use ever since the dawn of mass communication is what is called a false flag event, a false flag terror event. And it's something that's probably happened all through historical times. It's basically what organized crime would call framing somebody. It's when you commit a crime or perpetrate some kind of event like a murder, or you blow up a bridge or something like that, and you make sure it happens, but then you try to put the blame on somebody else through whatever way. You plant evidence, you know, there's all kind of different techniques and stuff. You've seen it in the movies millions of times. False flag. It's the same as perpetrating a crime but then putting the blame on somebody else. Well, false flag comes from some kind of, I'm not sure if there's a historical event that was supposed to be the first, but it's when like a ship would fly a flag from a different organization so that they could then be perceived as friendly, get up really close to another boat, and then they would jump on and take them over and kill all the people and steal all their cargo because it's not who they thought. So I think that's where it originates, but it has to do with it really went to the next level, because all of your psychological warfare people will tell you that the false flag is really only possible because in the world of mass communication, one event or the perception of an event can be broadcast into the minds of millions or billions of people almost instantaneously. So that's the power of it. You can perpetrate one little event, even if it's fully staged and orchestrated in the spirit of Edward Bernays. Then, with proper media coverage, it can be in everyone's mind in a split second. So that's exactly what all this false flag stuff has been. And if you read what I consider to be the true history of, like, the 20th century. There's many, many, many dozens of false flag events that if you read it from the perspective of mainstream history books, it's nothing like what really happened. But, for example, Pearl Harbor is known to be a false flag event. I mean, it really happened, and things did get blown up, and people were killed. But Japan didn't. It wasn't a surprise attack. America goaded Japan into attacking by blocking all their fuel transport. They knew they were going to attack. They moved all the naval vessels and stuff that they wanted to keep out of Pearl Harbor and left all the old junk stuff there to get blown up. They knew they were coming, and so, and then as soon as Japan attacked, they go like, oh, look, we've just been attacked. Let's go, and now we can officially enter World War II with the support of the public, that's what they were really trying to do, to gain the support of the public. The same thing with 9/11. The exact same thing. The same technique was used by a Save the Whales organization called Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, where their speedboat called the 80 Gill, skippered by Pete Bethune, a Kiwi dude, this was in like 2010, I think, after they had already taken this boat that was so loud that the crew had to wear earplugs to keep from being deafened, they took that boat down into the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. Then, later on, you can see from the video, Pete Bethune deliberately powered the 80 Gill directly into the path of this giant Japanese boat. And it split the boat in half, and then it sank. And then they cried, oh, look, look, the evil Japanese just tried to sink us and kill us. Can you just send us a lot of millions of dollars of donations? And that's exactly what happened. And I called bullshit on that from the instant it happened. And then a few months later, in New Zealand Maritime Court, Pete Bethune testified that, yes, that's exactly what he did, and under the orders of Captain Watson. And then now, 80 Gill, the owner of the boat, has sued both of them. They've all sued each other, and all this incredible bullshit, but all this was in the name of people who were out there supposedly to protect the whales. But this has absolutely nothing to do with that. It's as corrupt as can be. That is a form of false flag operation. This thing in New Zealand last Friday, clearly a false flag thing. It's got every hallmark of bullshit that you could see. And I'm not really going to go into it, but I'm just going to mention that if you look at what's happened with events like this, it doesn't matter what the content is of the videos that people might have seen, or the news articles, or what people have been told really happened. And sure, there appear to be at least a few people who actually were injured and shot and killed, but no one really knows for sure who shot them or where it happened. I'm sure that the videos that the public was able to see are completely fraudulent. But it's all beside the point, because the fact that all this was not just put on mass media after it happened, but it's sort of like the next generation of false flag media terrorism. It was live streamed on Facebook, which instantly makes Facebook totally complicit in this, as they are, because they're known to be a CIA asset anyway. But the main thing that happened is that almost everyone in New Zealand, and people in other countries too, including myself for a while, our attention was stolen away from anything else we were doing and put directly onto that. We were riveted, our eyes. They had us by the balls. The fish hooks came out and jabbed through everyone's eyeballs in an electronic way and made our face go onto the screen to look at all this news reporting and all the analysis and stuff like that. And it's just like, I use the analogy of a magician, like a stage magician. He's up there with his tuxedo on and he's got his hat. And they always have like a good-looking girl with a bikini on. The reason she's there is because most of the people, of course, all the men, probably a lot of the women, for whatever reason, they're going to be looking at the chick in the bikini. And she's moving around, blah, blah, blah. And so while your attention is focused on her, the magician can do pretty much anything he wants. He can pull something out of his pocket and pretend it came out of his hat, blah, blah, blah. But I liken this thing in New Zealand to the stage magician is up there and the chick's frolicking around in her bikini and stuff. And then all of a sudden she pops the top off of her bra and her giant boobs are flashing around and everybody's going, oh my God, look at that. And during that few second interval, the stage magician can do literally probably anything he wanted in full view because nobody's going to see it. And it's not that it's not in people's field of view. People are... It's like if you're filming something on a camera, it catches everything. Whereas if you're talking about how people's visual attention works, it's very, very different than a camera because you can actually have stuff clearly in your field of view that you did not see or notice because your attention was focused on a certain spot, a certain little focal area of that within your field of view. So that's a very interesting phenomenon in itself. And that works not only with vision, but also with hearing. Which the people behind advertising psychology and the psychology of mass communication, psychological warfare, they've been researching this stuff for 100 years. There's vast, probably every psychology department at every major university and every neurobiology department has research going on pertaining to all this stuff. It's fully weaponized. Television would be by far the greatest weapon system ever devised and in use. And all the more lethal and deadly and dangerous because it's not perceived as a weapon. If someone's got a gun pointed to your head, sure, you're going to be coerced, you're going to be obedient and compliant and obey. But if someone's got a television pointed at your face, you think that you're watching it voluntarily and that it's your friend, that it's accurate information and important, high-quality information and entertainment that's coming your way. This is not the case at all. It's the most weaponized instrument that you could possibly let into your mind for many, many, many different reasons. Jerry Mander wrote a very, very important book, which I've actually got the hard copy of it with me right now. It's called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. And everyone should read this book. One of the main reasons, one of the ways that television works is that there really is not a visual image on a television screen. It's not like a movie that's being projected on film. A video screen scans, has a little electron beam scanner that goes all over the screen really, really fast, like probably thousands of times a second. And it's tiny little dots that are lit up by the scanner. And that gives your brain the impression of an image. So the image is actually created in your brain. Well, the frequency of the scanning entrains with the different frequencies of our brain to sort of create a lock-in phenomenon called entrainment. And it means that if the scanning frequency is sort of in harmonic resonance with the dominant frequencies of your brain, like the alpha, beta, or theta rhythm, that tunes you in to this technology at that wavelength. So that in itself is why watching television is so literally hypnotic, not even metaphorically. It entrains your brain at a certain frequency that makes you kind of keep watching it, and it puts you into a state of kind of suggestive openness and also non-critical assimilation of whatever's on there. So it's really whatever the content or programming of a television show is secondary to why you keep sitting there watching it. It's the physiology of the technology itself. And there's a brilliant film called The Tube by Peter Intel of Switzerland, who authorized me over a decade ago to put up his film on my website, Regain Your Brain, so you can watch it on there. But it's about this exact physiological response between the scanning mechanism of the video screen and our brain. Also, if you study the psychology of mass media, the editors of papers and television shows and stuff, they know their motto is, if it bleeds, it leads. So anything that shows blood and gore, regardless of whose it is or why it happened, people just gobble that up. They buy the newspaper, they rubberneck, they watch it on the TV over and over again. And part of this is not just a morbid fascination, it's actually comes from the reptilian or limbic system of our brain that all mammals have. It has to do with our fight or flight responses. So whenever you see, like our distant ancestors as we've evolved, whenever you see blood, blood means danger and or food. It might mean that you're seeing something that's been injured, and it might be easier to kill because, and then if you're a predatory carnivore, blood is food or means food because you eat the meat and drink the blood of things that are recently killed or still alive. You're lapping it up. So that means food, but it also means danger, because if you're seeing blood, it could also mean that something's happening that means that you might be in danger too. So it activates these two very primal drives in all animals, all mammals, the urge to protect yourself and the urge to be a predator and get or attack some food or defend yourself. So when you see blood, the reptilian part of your brain has no choice but to zoom in on it and focus on it and to stay focused on it. So you can't, that's why basically whenever something like that, in any sort of perceived or real act of violence or accidents or people being shot or hit or stabbed or even screaming and yelling, all this stuff, it arouses the limbic system of your brain, and you don't have a choice but to watch it. So if you watch movies in recent years, which I tend to avoid, but I've really seen a change to how now modern day movies that come out, even by top people like, for example, Steven Spielberg, it's one continuous limbic system attractor, bait for your limbic system after another. It's a non-stop stream. And then the whole thing with sex and everything fits into that same reptilian brain. These are primal drives that it has nothing to do with being a conscious being. It's totally instinctive. Food, sex, protection, defense, fight or flight, these are all the stuff that television does. And it's almost like the storyline of the programs is completely secondary. It doesn't even matter. It sort of gives you it convinces your conscious mind that there's a reason that you're watching it, but it's really not the case. The reason that the powers that be orchestrate and foist false flag events are quite multitudinous, but every one of them serves many different functions. Like, I think this thing in New Zealand's been on the radar screen of this sort of New World Order mentality for a really, really long time, and for probably three important reasons, one of which is that in terms of the Western NATO, Anglo-American military-industrial alliance, New Zealand is their primary stepping stone to Antarctica, especially Christchurch. Antarctica is a very strategically important place. It's got more mineral resources probably than the rest of the world combined, even though it's under a mile or two of ice. That's secondary. It's also a strategic location for doing geophysical warfare because it's the only landmass located at polar latitudes. So, also New Zealand, especially the South Island, has been coveted by all these wealthy people for a long time as a place to live. It's also being sold off to foreign business interests, specifically China, like all the water rights and the amount of farms and vineyards and things that are owned by foreign, mainly Chinese interests and stuff is unbelievable. And it's also, New Zealand and Australia have both been kind of, because they're distant from the Northern Hemisphere population centers and remote island nations in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, they've served as socio-psychological laboratories for all kinds of weird experimentation. For example, there's an institution in London called the Tavistock Institute, T-A-V-I-S-T-O-C-K, Tavistock. It was founded after World War I by James Rawlings Rees, who was the father of psychological warfare in some ways, because he came up with the idea of firebombing Dresden in Germany, which was a completely non-military target. It was the arts and cultural center of Germany. He firebombed Germany, killing 100,000 people just as an act of psychological warfare to destroy the spirit of the people. So this is where Tavistock came from, and a psychiatrist by the name of Dax, D-A-X, relocated to Hobart, Tasmania in the 1950s so that he could conduct all kinds of psychiatric experiments on unwitting victims far, far away from the oversight of being in London. And guess who one of his clients was? A young Tasmanian guy with some mental issues named Martin Bryant, who then went on to be framed to have done the Port Arthur shootings in Tasmania in 1996, which facilitated the change of gun laws in Australia. And this thing in New Zealand is very, very, very similar to that. It's a lot of evidence exists that there's no way that it could have really been Martin Bryant that did these shootings. And it's this whole thing, the New Zealand thing, is a lot more complex than that, but I just don't think there's anything about the mainstream story that's actually true. But what you have to look at is, A, that it's distracted everybody from what they were doing, and there was some very important stuff happening in New Zealand, because I was just there. I was there for several months, from August till November, December, and then back in around Christmas up until just a couple of weeks ago. And there was more activism and awareness against the whole DOC and government deployment of this very dangerous pesticide called 1080, all the way back from when I arrived there in August up through when I left a couple of weeks ago. A massive amount of anti-1080 sentiment aroused in all the people. There was protests, there was TV shows, there was interviews, and it was big. This was huge, really, really huge. And then there was also a big uproar happening, mainly in Christchurch, but also in the Waikato region on the North Island, because of these Chinese companies that are coming in, buying up companies, like, for example, a wool processing business on the outskirts of Christchurch. But they had no interest in processing wool. It was to obtain the water rights. So this company called Ocean Blue got the water rights to this aquifer in Christchurch so that they could pump out billions of liters of water however often and bottle it up and send it back to China. And they were doing this, they actually got an application approval from Environmental Canterbury to drill a larger bore and suck out even more water. And the people of Christchurch were really pissed off about this. They were actually out in the streets protesting. This was happening like the week before the shooting happened. So you've got nationwide protests, thousands of people out in the street organized and protesting against 1080, against the Chinese water theft. You've got people like on Great Barrier Island, for example, with this program to dredge harbors in Auckland and then have these giant barges of toxic sediment shipped out and dumped about 24 kilometers east off the coast of the central part of Great Barrier Island. All this stuff, this was just in the week or two leading up to the shooting. So the main thing it did is it took everyone's attention. It derailed, possibly permanently, a lot of this momentum that was gaining in people who were actually interested in protecting what's left of the sanctity and undisruptedness of New Zealand as a whole. And now it's also created gun law legislation change, which, you know, on the surface, I mean, really, who does need automatic weapons? But the whole point of the Second Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, the right to bear arms. It's not about people being armed and walking around with guns so they can shoot people and stuff like that in an offensive way. The right to bear arms is for protection. It's so that people, if they were under attack by an enemy, specifically a totalitarian regime, an oligarchy, an evil king, or a government that wants to force them into slavery or prevent them from doing what they want to do, an army couldn't just come in and take over without risking a lot of casualties to themselves, or possibly even defeat. If the public is armed and able to defend themselves, that hopefully they would never have to do it, but it serves as what's called a deterrent, because the invading army or regime is not just going to wade in there and force people what to do if they're fully armed. So that's what the Second Amendment is all about. It's about deterrence. So I think a lot of people in New Zealand have that same idea, even though a lot of people that own guns are hunters, which, you know, I guess it's their right to do it. I'm not a fan of hunting, going and killing animals and stuff like that, but, you know, a lot of the hunters are some of the top opposition to 1080, which makes sense. Who wants to kill and eat a deer or a pheasant that's full of 1080 poison? Or walk down through a forest that's where the stream is littered with the body of dead deer and possums and goats, mountain goats and stuff like that. So who knows what else? I think they've also clamped down on, I'm not sure of the actual legal status, because New Zealand's always had sort of objectionable materials regulations relating to, you know, if you've got videos that are, you know, pornographic or that show whatever, anything they want to say is objectionable to that, you know, and I think that that's actually good. But at the same time, it can be, now if they declare that anyone watching any of this video is a criminal now, even though it was live streamed on Facebook, I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. So I don't, this is just this kind of gray area. But anyway, it's all an excuse, because the thing of psychological warfare is then that people are shocked and traumatized by these events. And then in that, those moments of confusion and being shocked, people are quite susceptible to listening to or obeying or assimilating anything that they want to shove down your throat. So this whole past week has been an exercise in that. I've deliberately distanced myself from it. I haven't let too much of this in my mind, and people were going off the deep end with looking at all the, for example, the all the sort of New Age metaphysical Illuminati symbols and names that were on these guns that were supposedly actually fake guns. And just all this stuff, and going like, you know, it's just, it's not worth letting your mind share be sapped by all this stuff. I've told people, kind of, and I'm not trying to be gross or anything, I think it's really true. My message to New Zealand is this. Just because someone might come and take a shit on your kitchen table doesn't mean that you have to eat it. You could thank them for their generosity and go like, you know, I'm really not hungry now, but thanks anyway. Or you could put it in the freezer and save it for later. Or you could clean it off and go flush down the toilet and clean your table. Or you could have had the option of not even letting someone into your house who could do that. So this is a very good metaphor for television. You know, the metaphor of what you put into your mouth and what you let into your brain. It's very similar. It's the reason I don't eat at McDonald's, because it's not food. I don't watch mainstream television unless I sort of am visiting someone and they happen to have it on. Or, you know, they might say, Jeff, come here and look. They're showing something about climate change, you know. And it's like, I'm going like, so false flags. The main thing we're talking about here is critical thinking versus uncritical assimilation, because what you choose to let into your mind is equally, if not maybe even more important, than the food you put into your body or the toxins, the toxicity, because the quality of the nutrients that you put into your mind, that you let in through what you see, through what you hear, what your sources of information are, the amount of this and that that you take in, this is the raw material from which you create your perception of reality, your worldview. And our worldview has been weaponized ever since the importation of many, many, many Nazi psychiatrists into America under Operation Paperclip after World War II. They had an expression called the Weltanschauungskrieg. Weltanschauungskrieg. It means world view warfare. So what that is, it's the decades or generations long externally imposed mutation of what people think of as reality. For example, some of the private foundations before World War I, Norman Dodds was investigating these foundations to see if they were un-American. It was commissioned by the Rees Committee from the White House at that time. And the Ford Foundation said that one of their goals was to control what Americans thought of as history. So first of all, they tried to buy off all the leading historians of their day, but they told them to shove it. So what they did was we've got plenty of time. What we'll do is we'll create all these scholarships so that we can then create the next generation of historians who will then write history in the way that we want them to. I'll read a couple of quotes to you from some very important sources. If you give a man the correct information for 7 years, he may believe the incorrect information on the first day of the eighth year when it is necessary from your point of view that he should do so. Your first job is to build credibility and the authenticity of your propaganda and persuade the enemy to trust you, although you are his enemy. Psychological warfare is at best a cumbersome and pretentious label for an important modern political and military weapon, the use of mass communication, and is one of the few completely legitimate weapons which can on occasion be directed against an entirely civilian and non-combatant target. This is Jeff Phillips, Wefferson, signing off here. Live simply so that others may simply live. Check out regainyourbrain.org. Many thanks to Jules Stanley at UCY-TV. And just because someone takes a shit on your kitchen table does not mean that you have to eat it. Good day.
Go ahead, doctor. Make a diagnosis.
Foreign object. Bullet, it looks like, in the chest cavity.
All right. How about this one?
Lesion in the heart area. Maybe in the lungs. Might be carcinoma.
4 o'clock? Or just a fog in the plate? Could be any number of things. But what is it really? Just a shadow play? A pattern to be used for intelligent guesswork? A slight help towards saving the life of the man who made those shadows?
Immense help, Dr. Xavier.
Now, when you have nothing better, anything is an immense help. That's light. Waves of energy that excite the eye. And the nerve cells transmit this energy to the brain. And with the brain, we see. But there are other forms of energy with different wavelengths.
Dr. Xavier, I've read your report.
Yes, but do you understand it? Have you any idea what I'm trying to accomplish here?